Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that puts the news in fake news. My name's Corey Hazelest, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Now, Steve, this is the third of three episodes looking at the issue of Islamophobia. We looked at the rise of far-right terrorism in our first episode. In the second one, we talked about Islamophobia in the Tory party. In this one, we're going to talk about the role of the media in perpetuating Islamophobia. Since, though, we recorded our episode on the Conservative Party and Islamophobia, we had 15 Tory councillors who were investigated for Islamophobia who were quietly reinstated by the party. We had Facebook posts from people purporting to be Conservative supporters who were talking about trying to block Sajid Javid from becoming Prime Minister in the prospective Tory party leadership race. We had Roger Scruton, who was, for some reason, a housing advisor to the government, who lost his job over several remarks he made, one of which was tribes of Muslims coming to Europe.
Yeah, Roger Scruton, a man described by the Guido Fawkes blog earlier this week as a good egg and who should absolutely be paid attention to, despite the fact he was running George Soros conspiracies.
So, we are going to talk about the role of the media then in Islamophobia and maybe what we can try and do about it. So we'll start, Steve, with a few headlines. I want you to tell me what they've all got in common. So we've got Islamist school can segregate girls and boys. We've got anger as a third of Muslim nations sign up to a coalition against ISIS. We've got half of British Muslims would not go to cops if they knew someone with ISIS links. We've got new £5 notes could be banned by religious groups as bank can't promise their halal. Half of UK Muslims would not report extremism. Enclaves of Islam see UK 75% Muslim. Or British Muslims are so cut off from society they think 75% of the UK is Islamic. What have they all got in common?
Well, my guess is they're all coming from right-wing newspapers. They're all basically coming out from a perspective of being rather negative about Muslims and people of the Islamic faith.
So you say right-wing newspapers. Do you reckon they're tabloids or broadsheets?
Combination of all of the above.
Ooh. Yeah, it is. And, well, so some... For a couple of those from the Sunday Times, or one from the Times, one from the Sunday Times. What's the other thing they've all got in common?
Oh, probably strongly involved Birmingham in some capacity, at least in a byline mention in the article, I imagine.
Obscure Birmingham reference already. That wasn't quite what I was thinking of. There's another thing as well, which is that they're all misleading. So all of them,
of course,
inaccurate.
Yeah.
Fake news, Steve. Come on,
I've just been so bludgeoned by fake news. I just can't recognise it anymore.
And the other thing it's got in common is that all those newspapers then had to correct or retract though, or rewrite those headlines afterwards. So,
but of course those retractions were never given anywhere near the same prominence as the original story, as is the way of these things and as is traditional.
It feels like one of the things you could do overnight to try and improve the standards of the media is just to say, right, the correction for the article has to go in the same font on the same page as the original article was.
Yeah, I mean, that would just massively screw over a lot of the papers. Oh, this has to be on your front page. Well, maybe you'd be a bit more careful with what you put out.
A lot of the problem, I suppose, is that these stories about Muslims in the media, it does a couple of things, doesn't it? I mean, one of them is it changes people's attitude to Muslims in society. And we've talked about that on previous episodes, about a lot of people, good chunk of the British public, don't think that Muslims integrate, think that Islam is incompatible with the British way of life. Something else that these news stories do as well is it affects how Muslims go about their day-to-day lives. There's been a study, for instance, of mothers who are Islamic. They talk in the study about trying to get medical treatment. One of the things that they say is that, you know, they want to talk about the implications of fasting and this kind of thing. There's a reluctance for these mothers to talk about fasting when they go to their doctors and their GPs, because I think they're scared of the reaction that they might get. You know, almost this Muslim mother who's talking about fasting, what is she? Is she some kind of extremist? And what, of course, that means is
that these women are denied the medical treatment that they need.
Fundamentally, this is one of the core problems that Islamophobia actually creates. Like, we tend to focus almost on like the big kind of bangs, the big events that you
don't talk
about.
Big bangs, Steve.
Yeah, we tend to focus on like the big events, the flashpoints almost, where you can say, oh, well, this person was attacked by a Muslim. There's a terrorist attack. Or to flip it on the other way around, maybe a Muslim individual gets attacked by a member of the far right. That kind of thing. We tend to focus on those individual events, and we don't tend to talk about or look at the impacts that these misleading headlines actually have on the day-to-day lives of regular British people who just happen to be Muslim.
Also, these headlines aren't necessarily about terror attacks either.
No, they're not.
But we haven't even really talked about the perception of Islamic terror. These headlines are all... It's almost like a drip-drip effect of how... The impression is that Muslims aren't compatible with the British way of life.
Yeah, it's classic example of othering of a section of society and saying they are different to us, they cannot be trusted. Like, if you run through those the article headlines that we were going through earlier, like, you've got wonderful little things in, like, oh, Muslims don't trust the police, Muslims won't report extremists, Muslims won't do this, that, or the other. It's all about kind of creating this sense of Islam and its worshippers being separate from the rest of society for whatever reason, and as a result of that, making them that right-wingy ideologies, and I mean right in that as in hard right and far right, need to actually propagate themselves. Because if you don't have that other, you can't have kind of like the hard right ideologies as well as that leading to fascism.
And this is the definition of nationalism that we talked about in the first episode on Islamophobia, in the, I mean, glibly, the difference between a patriot and a nationalist is that a patriot loves his country, whereas a nationalist hates everyone else's. But the idea of a nationalist is that you need to have, like, the nation's in decay, it needs restoring, but there's also this group that's
responsible for it. Yeah, that's the key thing. There's always someone on the inside who's responsible for the moral and economic decay of society, and because there's a group that's responsible, you can do something about that group.
And certainly in David Neerich, I think his name is, who wrote Alt America, which is a look on the far right in America, talks about this use of eliminationist rhetoric, starting with, you know, dehumanising rhetoric. And actually, you're seeing it with Donald Trump today, talking about how asylum seekers aren't even people, they're animals. And I don't think it's a surprise that the man responsible for the shooting of a Christchurch mosque, where he shot 50 people essentially because they were Muslims, mentions Donald Trump and mentions the fact that essentially he inspired him to become a white supremacist.
It's interesting you mentioned like the Christchurch attack there, because that the guy responsible for that was, and I think we might have mentioned this on one of the other episodes, but he was basically influenced by pretty much every single stereotypical kind of like far right notion of what it means to be a Muslim. So he had items which bore messages talking about Rotherham, obviously referencing the child sex abuse scandals and events which have happened up there, which, if you listen to UKIP and you listen to Tommy Robinson and the EDL, what you end up with is a picture of, oh, the media isn't talking about this, no one's actually looking after our kids, these Islamic paedophiles are just open to abuse anyone they like. In reality, that's not the case at all. There was a paedophile ring. A load of them were Muslims, if not all of them were Muslims. But the media has been reporting it so much to the extent that Tommy Robinson gets a lot of TV time, so much to the extent that UKIP get TV time off the back of it. This is the thing with a lot of these kind of like headlines, is that they start to feed into this narrative, which then becomes self-reinforcing as people kind of don't break out of their own social bubbles. You end up just kind of reinforcing it, feeding it over and over and over again, which just creates more and more extreme views, which in turn creates more and more extreme actions. And as a result, you end up with Christchurch. As a result, you end up with people not trusting Muslims because they view them as different and refusing potentially to even serve them or whatever. You know, we are on the precipice of something quite disgusting and dangerous, and I genuinely do believe this. It's not going to take much to turn large sections of this country into demanding you know, Muslims get rounded up.
Well, we've already had people driving cars into groups of people outside mosques already in this country to try and kill them because they're Muslim, and we've had left-wing MP being assassinated, essentially. I mean, the thing with the media coverage is a lot of different groups will try and claim that there's media bias of one form or another, and, I mean, you see it on the Sunday Times story as well, don't you? We alluded to it over anti-Semitism. And people will say, oh, but where is the Sunday Times story into Islamophobia in the Tory party? I mean, actually, the Sunday Times has run stories on the far-right people who are Islamophobes, who are backing people like Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg, that they have run that front page. But you even have BBC journalists saying, oh, well, I bet you're not going to talk about this story in the BBC, and then linking to a story from the BBC about that story. So it feels like there's almost a bit of a victim mentality among a lot of these kind of, a lot of political groups nowadays. We've talked a little bit about Andrew Adonis doing things like that as well, yeah. Talking about BBC bias. But it feels to be that's a way that political groups try and develop their group identity, is by playing against the media. Yeah. Meanwhile, ignoring the fact that actually the media are, or a lot of the British media are propagating very negative stories about Muslims, which are inaccurate.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing that kind of really gets on my wick when it comes to the likes of Andrew Adonis and the Follow Back pro-European brigade, is that they are so quick to kind of jump into any argument of surrounding, oh yeah, misrepresentation of the people's vote, misrepresentation on something to do with the EU or whatever, and yet the silence, to be honest, from my perspective, is practically deafening whenever it comes to these sorts of headlines, which are blatantly bullshit, blatantly misleading, and outright lies concerning one of the most potentially in danger segments of society because of the kind of like recent history. And answers there come then on. No, there doesn't seem to be much, if any, outrage. Really, if outrage does exist, it tends to come from the likes of Owen Jones and that kind of aspect of the left. But even then, it seems to come as whataboutism. And it's, as you said earlier, it's what about this Islamophobia, which is happening? Why aren't you talking about this instead of anti-Semitism? When in reality, we should be talking about both.
To come to the defence of Owen Jones slightly, I think he's one of the few people...
Oh, he has been consistent.
...in the media who will talk about the structural bias in the media.
Yes.
In the fact that there are lots of white, fairly well-educated, middle-class, Oxbridge-educated journalists. Now, obviously, when he does that, you then get 4 million replies from people to say, well, I grew up in a tent made out of hummus and twigs and worked my way up and passed the 11 plus, and now I am a sub-editor for an obscure Basildon newspaper. It's always that anecdote trumping maybe greater truth. I suppose the point is that these stories were misleading. I mean, just to take, say, the Halal banknote, for instance, the fact that there were lots of different groups who were complaining about the composition of the new banknote, including, I believe, I think vegan friends of mine weren't terribly happy about the composition of it, but using the word halal in the headline,
suddenly it becomes a lot scarier.
Well, it's just Muslims who are objecting, yeah, rather than actually a group of other people. Or, for instance, the group about, there was a story about the isolated Muslims cut off from society. Well, that comes from a government report that found one secondary school, a single secondary school, which had an overwhelming population of South Asian students, who they had a survey and thought the British population was something like 59% Asian, because that's what their experience is, because, yeah, that's all they know.
And the thing is, if you take any school, doesn't matter whether what region it's from or whatever, and ask its kids those kind of questions, they will probably spit out the kind of rough numbers of the school that they're in and the areas they're in. That's just how kids process things. They don't necessarily understand that sample sizes and things like that. They just know that this is what life is, so therefore it must be the same everywhere else.
And it isn't just the tabloids, as we've said. So the Times, for instance, had a few headlines a couple of years ago, which the first headline, Christian child forced into Muslim foster care, which was about two Muslim foster families in Tower Hamlets who were apparently failing to look after a Christian child properly. Whereas, actually, all of that was nonsense. all of the story, in fact, wasn't true. Just for instance, one of the things that was wrong is it said that the Muslim family had taken the child's crucifix away. Actually, what had happened was they'd removed the child's gold crucifix for safekeeping because it was large and expensive, and you don't want a young child going around with lots of expensive jewellery.
No, absolutely, because it's going to get nicked.
Everything gets twisted. And this is from the Times is meant to be the voice of the British establishment, but it's also the paper in which you have articles by people like Melanie Phillips saying that Islamophobia is just a fiction to shut down debate, or has Rod Little with a column every week.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so many kind of things to delve into when it comes to that example, and that's before you even get into Phillips and like Rod Little, both of which are disgusting, broadly speaking in general, but most definitely on this topic. But what really gets me is that people like Phillips, people like Lidl, will jump on like examples, using the loosest term, the definition of the term there, like the one you just gave there about the Christian kid who was fostered by Muslims. They'll jump on that as an example of this is terrible about, because it's these Muslims doing this, that, and the other. But they won't talk about the other issues in the foster system, the fact that you will probably almost certainly find examples of foster kids of Muslim backgrounds being put in Christian households, largely, hopefully, broadly well, but there will almost certainly be issues which would need to be dealt with, almost certainly be issues and misunderstandings, but they won't talk about that at all. They'll only focus on these sorts of areas when it aligns to their negative portrayal of Islam. And they're just happy to continue doing this because there's been no repercussion for them at all.
I think the other thing that does is that it ignores, like a lot of, I suppose, media reporting does, is it ignores the structural failings in any kind of foster system, and the fact that, and even the adoption system, of actually, maybe, to be fair, the Times have maybe tried to pick up on the fact that there's a bit of an adoption crisis, but it's overlooking the structural failings and instead assuming it's all about failures of individuals and failings of personality or character, or the fact that it's just because people are evil and bigoted, rather than it being a wider system failure, which maybe is leading to these things. And I think that's the thing that's often overlooked too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Phillips and Lidl, mainly Phillips, Rod Lidl, also have something in common, which is that they work for The Spectator. And The Spectator also employs people like Brendan O'Neill, who will give you the contrarian hot take for 500 words at a very reasonable price. People like Douglas Murray, who've written books on how Europe is at threat. The Strange Death of Europe is a book essentially talking about Muslim immigration, how that's going to lead to the end of Europe as we know it.
Yeah, I mean, the Spectator, one of, if not the oldest, I think, magazine, magazine in the UK, quite possibly the world, actually, given how long it's been going around, is basically become an alt-right, and I mean this term quite literally, an alt-right publication. The people that it's bringing in and talking about these issues on a daily basis are just ripping off talking points of the far right in a lot of ways. You know, this is a magazine which plays host to Tacky, who is one of their columnists, who writes about how you must deep down admit that the German army on D-Day were brave and powerful. And it's like, what are you on about, mate? Like, they were yes, they were regular people who'd been drafted and all kinds of things like that, but you're idealising Nazism as part of all of your kind of ridiculousness. And yet The Spectator is still taken seriously as a publication, despite the fact that it's gone off the deep end completely.
James Denningpole as well often writes for it, and I think has written a few of the diary columns, and again is, I think, Breitbart heavily involved with that kind of alt-right. I mean, The Spectator is in an interesting position because it's also got people like Isabel Harpman, Katie Balls, James Forsyth, who I think are three of the more well-connected and insightful commentators on the Westminster bubble.
Absolutely.
But then edited by someone like, I think, Fraser Nelson, their editor, last week, I think, published an article to the effect of, well, an editor's not responsible for the copy that his writers write. You think, well, if you employ people like James Dunning-Powell and Melanie Phillips and Rod Little, what are you expecting?
Nelson's an interesting little figure because actually when you kind of see his actual opinions on things, he's not necessarily that right wing. You know, he's plain, obviously, a Tory, but he's kind of that relatively moderate Tory, maybe leaning towards One Nation, or at least in the past he's kind of given that appearance. I think he was pro-Remain initially, at least at one point during the campaign. I might be wrong on that. But he's not an off-the-deep-end kind of guy. But he's just seemed to have completely advocated any position of influence in his editorial decisions, and he's just saying, nah, these guys are just going to write what they like. And fundamentally, it's because that's what the spectator readers want to read, and he doesn't want to deny that, because then he potentially loses his job because readership declines.
Well, I think it's a mixture of most of the things, isn't it? I mean, a lot of the problem with the media coverage is hate sells. You know, exaggerated articles give you clickbait. It's not just it plays to an echo chamber that we've already talked about being bear of white nationalism, but then also people like us who, like idiots, will go, have you seen the latest terrible thing that has been linked?
And that has been written
in the States. Indeed. And actually, the invention of the screenshot on the iPhone maybe stops that a little bit, because you end up, rather than giving them clicks, you just screenshot it and tweet it, and maybe there's less online traffic. Also, the invention of a paywall as well. And it's hard to, especially on the Telegraph and Spectator sites, kind of hard to justify one's pay subscription to an online magazine. I think the other thing is, an editor's job is to hire writers he think are good, who then write stuff. And saying, oh well, I've hired Rod Little and Melanie Phillips and James Dalyppol, and it turns out they're writing stuff that's not very nice. And you think, well, it's a bit like saying, well, I've ordered the mixed grill and I'm really surprised to find it's not a vegetarian option.
Yeah, if you've got literally decades worth of material to look at to find out what their views are on things, never mind the stuff that you've been having to read week in, week out for God knows how many years as editor. Like, you can't be surprised that they're writing things like this. Mm. And yet, Fraser Nelson just seems to be kind of washing his hands of it, because it would make his life difficult.
Fraser Nelson. Kelsey Grammer is.
Yeah, absolutely.
That could be an interesting episode swap, where Fraser edits The Spectator and then Fraser Nelson ends up in a Seattle coffee bar. But I digress. And I think the other thing with it as well is, Phillips writing things like Islamophobia is some sort of fiction to shut down a debate and to not talk about the issue of Islamic extremism. I mean, A, have you not seen the depictions of the media? Have you not seen the amount of negative stories that are out there and the amount of stories that are discussing Islam? And it's always this, always used to happen, Phil Willis reference, but you know, every so often you talk about we need to have a debate over immigration. You think we never really stopped having debates over immigration.
Yeah, like there was always something being said about it. There was always a debate. It's just that it wasn't the debate that you wanted, because we weren't saying kick them all out.
And so we've always had a debate over a debate over the nature of Islam, if you want to put it like that. But I think the other thing is, and it's something we didn't really mention, the difference between Islamophobia in the Tory party and anti-Semitism in the Labour party. And the thing is, when you see a story, or certainly when I see a story about anti-Semitism in the Labour party, okay, there's a few people who are sitting on their hands and lots of people who maybe are just putting their fingers in their ears and hoping the problem will go away. But I also see a lot of Labour members outraged. I see Momentum doing videos
trying to educate people.
Educating people on anti-Semitism and Hope Not Hate, I think, have praised what Momentum are doing on that now. And the Jewish Labour movement, yes, they passed a motion of no confidence in Jeremy Corbyn, but they did praise Momentum and say they were taking action. I see Tom Watson, the deputy leader of the Labour Party, saying he's anti-racist. I do see shadow cabinet members as well saying that anti-racist. I see lots of Labour members doing that as well. I don't see the same on the issue of Islamophobia in the Tory party and in the right-wing press generally.
No, you don't. In fact, when it comes to Islamophobia on the right, there's really only one person who's actually making any noise on this, and that's Baroness Saeeda Wasi. But she's taking a stand and basically has torched her standing in the party, and it's only by the fact that she's in the House of Lords already that she's been able to maintain any influence at all. If she were an MP, she'd been out on her ear. If she was just a talking head, she'd be out on her ear. Props to her in general for actually standing up on this. But yeah, she is a lone voice in the forest here. There's no one else backing her up on the right, because they either don't see it's an issue, or they are just being willfully kind of ignoring it because they know that it's going to open a Pandora's box that they don't want to deal with.
There's a survey, I think, that was out in the press this week that said if there was an Islamist committing some sort of offence, 78% of news articles would label that person a terrorist. Far-right extremist in the same situation, only 27% of news articles would name them as a terrorist. And you see something fairly similar, again, a bit of a Twitter storm in a teacup, over the killing of Joe Cox 3 years ago. And so some people called it an assassination. Well, Peter Hitchens said, well, you shouldn't call it an assassination. It wasn't a political crime because the killer was mentally ill and it was a mental issue.
This is the thing that really gets me. Like, the gentleman who killed Lee Rigby, Michael Adebolajo, I think I'm pronouncing that right, was mentally ill as well. I think they came out and actually basically diagnosed him with some form of schizophrenia and all kinds of stuff. Like, mental illness does absolutely factor into people's decisions to commit these sorts of crimes, but they never seem to focus on mental illness when it's a Muslim doing it or somebody who isn't white. In what you tend to get instead is I think it was the Daily Mirror who, for some god-awful reason, decided to run a front page which talked about the Christchurch killer and comparing him as a child to now and saying, look at his angelic face as a child. And it's like, what are you trying to do here? You would never run that for anybody else. Like, you don't do those contrasts for anybody else. Why on earth are you normalising this terrorist? Why on earth are you normalising this white supremacist, this man who's literally sought to go out of his way to kill people in the name of a twisted ideology?
One final thing, if we can maybe end with this. We had a minor disagreement in our first episode because you were talking about the extent to which the media influences society, or is the media a reflection of the society in it? Well, there's a couple of studies that seem to indicate that those who have more personal contact with Muslims have a much favour impression of Muslims.
Absolutely,
and those who have their only impression of Muslims from media. In a similar way, studies in America have found people who only experience of African Americans is through the media have a much more negative viewpoint of them than they do if they've had more personal contact.
Yeah, absolutely. There is, without a doubt, evidence that shows that the media shapes people's opinions. That is, like, I don't think that's controversial to say that. I think the point I was trying to make previously, there's a kind of a self-reinforcing cycle with these sorts of things, especially when it comes to print media or media where you're trying to basically turn a profit. Because essentially what happens is you need to cater to an audience to get them to buy your product, which means you need to provide them what they already like. Now, because you have this wider ecosystem of, in this instance, Islamophobia, people already hold that opinion, and so you end up taking that position yourself, or not being as harsh on it as you might otherwise would have been, Fraser Nelson as an example, which results in an increase in the extremeness of the rhetoric, which in turn feeds into everything else. So the media does shape things, absolutely, and the lack of personal connection is the key point I would say there. It's the fact that people don't. So you can see how people do get into that sort of thing, that situation where they don't necessarily meet these people, and the only thing they get is what their media bubble that they've signed up to and are being tweeted at constantly and shared on Facebook constantly is all they see.
In the meantime, if you want to keep in touch with our media bubble, our website's notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram, and Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. I'm at Paperback Writer.
I'm at Acoustic Radical.
Happy plotting.